Hey folks, you're listening to The Idea Roastery. I'm Herman.
And I'm Jason.
And we're getting to that time of year that it ends. turns out that happens every year. And as with the previous years, we've decided it's a pretty good time to take a look back at what happened over 2023, both as a part of the show and also the world as a whole, and yes, just chat about it.
We've got three themes. The first one being climate, which is a fun topic of ours, which will lead into energy. And the last one being the obvious elephant in the chat box, AI. And so, first of all, it looks quite warm there where you are.
It's actually really good. So Cape Town is, funnily enough, having a bit of a cooler summer than usual. It's delightful. I'm enjoying it. Johannesburg has had a few heat waves, and there's a good chance that January, February is going to be really hot. But overall, things are nice and cool here. We did have a particularly cold winter, but overall, the world isn't looking as cool as Cape Town. You know, at the end of the movie 2012, everyone just rocks up in Cape Town, the Cape of Good Hope, and they're like, here's where we will live. It's kind of like that. You know, it's just, yeah, we don't have earthquakes here. We don't have tropical storms here. We don't have hurricanes here. So it's a microcosm where we can't judge the entire global climate based on how things are going in Cape Town.
I mean, probably don't go, because then there'll be too many people, and we'll have a crisis of influx of people.
We have crime. Stay away.
Yeah. It's not that great. But one of the first stories is the population, right? So when I was in school, I always had this 6 billion number in my head, and I think it's kind of like stuck onto me, you know, because it's not something that I look at on a daily basis, you know, like the price of oil or whatever. Not that I do that either, but it's now gonna get to 8 billion by the end of the year.
Another B in the book,
which is 2 billion more than I expected, and it kind of explains a lot, right? We've got a lot more people coming into the picture, and so there's typically knock-on effects, and I think that's what we're maybe seeing in terms of climate, right? There's almost like a non-decrease in CO2 levels. It's kind of just gone up, and it's resulted in, I don't know if it's directly resulted, but we've basically hit all-time highs for the ocean temperatures. We've hit it for the average daily temperatures, which I think passed the 2 degrees from pre-industrial era, which is quite a big number, because I remember 2 degrees being like, we're screwed if we get this far. We're still here. And then there's also inland water temperatures, which I saw in September reaching really high temperatures, and almost to the extent that it's actually heating up more than coastal waters or oceans, right? Which is something I don't really think about. But overall, like, it's getting hotter.
I think that there's a couple of things over here, and the increase in population is definitely one of them. However, I think a more important factor is that the population is becoming wealthier. And as a population becomes wealthier, the amount of waste that they generate increases a lot. I mean, like, the standard person in the West produces significantly, you know, potentially even orders of magnitude more waste in the form of either carbon dioxide from energy production to plastics and whatnot, and land used for agriculture, than someone in the developing world. And so we've got things happening on both sides. We've got a fairly consistent size of populations inside of developed countries, and developing countries are growing in population. And most notably, India has recently surpassed China and in the number of people that they have. But then there's also a second one, and I think this one's really interesting. We discussed it on our geoengineering episode, where shipping ships, container ships were banned from using high sulfur fuel. And this is definitively a good thing because it was bad, did create a lot of particulate matter, and the aerosols weren't great. Well, except for with regard to creating a aerosol layer that reflected sunlight back into space. And so by banning this definitively worse version of diesel, we inadvertently actually sped up global warming, or we didn't necessarily speed up global warming, we just removed a thing that was slowing it down. And so we've actually seen a significant increase in warming temperatures around the planet. And so that's definitely a cause for alarm. But one of the things that I find neat about it is that we were inadvertently experimenting, doing a geoengineering experiment. And so we can now definitively say, yeah, we can inject sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere and it'll cool us down.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of sort of fun journeys that happened, right? Because I think overall is a very complicated thing, but I think you're right. There are attempts being made. I think especially I think around about Feb there was the EU saying that they're going to ban I think it's petrol or fossil fuel based cars by 2020. Is it 2030? 2035, which is pretty good.
The sale or the operation? Probably
Is
just
it
the sale.
sale of new cars?
New
Yeah,
ones, yeah.
which is good because it kind of sets a standard of when at least electrification will come in. And I think cars do make up a good portion, and I think it is kind of semi-related to the development of a country. Like as you become more prosperous, there's a chance that you buy a car and you've got more disposable income, so you go on holidays and stuff. So I think that's kind of a good sign, and it's good to see that there are people tackling the different challenges. Which I guess moves us into the second one, which is the energy stuff.
Yeah, so there's been some exciting stuff that happened in energy. It's I think the we'll get into some of the more novel things about energy, but I think that the biggest impact thing to happen to the energy sector is just how good we have gotten at manufacturing solar and wind, in that the price has continued to decrease sharply throughout this year and, the prior 20 years, to the extent that currently it is more profitable to open a new solar farm than it is to continue running an existing coal-fired power plant. And just that figure alone is very, very heartening, in that economics is actually going to push us towards decarbonization as opposed to, just public goodwill and governmental incentives.
Yeah, so there's I've definitely noticed like a speed up in all of the sort of hard tech problems, right? We are seeing the price of solar go down. There's new efficiency gains in solar. I think organic solar cells have pushed the boundaries. I think they got 20% efficiency this year.
Yeah, perovskites are also made a lot of headway. Perovskite solar cells, which also have theoretical, not well, at least they have lab scale tests that show some pretty great efficiency as well.
But on the negative, we don't have a superconductor at room temperature. I remember that.
Yes, we don't. We were actually going to. Did we do a podcast on that, or were we
I
planning
think
to?
we were going to. I don't know if we did.
Right, yeah, we were like, okay, if this manages to get recreated by a third party lab before our next podcast episode, then we'll do a podcast on it. And both you and I were healthily skeptical, but I was like feeling pretty optimistic. And then it came out that it was actually just a novel material that had a specific effect that gave it conductor-like attributes, but not in the places that it mattered.
Yeah, I think we got hype punked. Like, I think there was a lot of hype around it, and everyone was like, "Oh, this is so exciting!" And thinking of the possibilities, and then I think it just wasn't. It didn't turn to be, right. Yeah, I mean, it would be. I think it would be like quite ironic, like a fate of irony, you know, where the solution to room temperature superconductors was just like some like random materials that you could like.
Just around the corner,
You could
yeah,
just stick
some
together
Korean
and
lab
just
just whipped together some stuff.
drop it off your table, and then suddenly you've got a superconductor. So, I think I think we're maybe a longer way away from that.
If it is even possible.
If it's even possible, that's true.
So you know that whole thing where it's like you find a lamp and a genie comes out, and the genie's like, I can grant you one wish, and you can't wish for unlimited wishes. I've been thinking about that, and I think that my wish would be complicated. I'd be like, bestow upon me the knowledge that I could make a really big energy breakthrough, such as, if possible, a room temperature semiconductor or a way to produce net gain fusion sustainably.
And able to be produced with the materials that we have on hand.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I want to be able to make like a back alley fusion.
Yeah, because you don't want it to be like, you know, just take the sun and just wrap a thing around it and just absorb all the energy of that. Yeah, so I mean, wish making, there's a whole episode we could do on like what would be the perfect wish. But I think with the superconductors, it's going to be cool, because I have noticed a couple of startups that are starting to simulate materials. There's a lot more compute around, and so there's companies that are looking to basically like formulate sort of theoretical materials and then test them for superconductivity. And then, you know, the ones that kind of look like they're plausible, they'll try and like fabricate them in a lab.
And that's actually really cool. That's kind of what we were doing with protein folding,
Yeah.
right? Is you just take a whole bunch of really hardcore compute, you combine a whole bunch of molecules in novel ways, in as many ways as you can reasonably do with the amount of compute that you've been allocated. And then if they show any novel properties inside of the simulation, you're like, okay, let's make this in the lab. And who knows, maybe something really, really neat will come out
Yeah,
of it.
exactly. There were two downsides. Well, there was a downside in the energy world. I remember that Germany switched off their nuclear power plant. So I think it was ex I think there's like a turn in the tone of people around nuclear. I think people's mi well, maybe my mind's always been a bit pro, but I think people's minds are becoming a little bit more pro that type of energy. Although we did say that you do have solar becoming a pretty sort of middleweight fighter in terms of the energy battle. But I think people's understanding of that, you know, nuclear could form a sort of part of our energy mix in the future. Whether that translates to South Africa, I know there's been a bit of a kerfuffle recently, because I think they're opening up bidding for a new nuclear power station.
So it's complicated. It's complicated, and we don't have to dig into this too far, but for any, regular listeners over here, they'll know that we're quite pro nuclear as a as an energy source, because it is definitively safe and clean, and there are a lot of modern ways to create energy out of splitting atoms that don't have as high of a risk of, thermal runaway and meltdowns and all that good stuff. However, there is good reason to think that renewable energy sources such as wind and solar, especially if they continue their current trajectory, and also especially if battery technology increases its current trajectory, which it seems to be doing, especially with things like sodium ion and solid state batteries and other novel battery chemistries for grid scale storage, that outside of niche applications where, let's take for instance, there isn't much sun or isn't much wind or isn't much space, because both wind and solar require space, there's good evidence to suggest that actually renewable might be able to power the world fairly efficiently. And we might not actually need what is an incredibly expensive form of energy. Like, nuclear is great, but it's also really, really expensive.
Yeah, I agree. I think for our current needs, right, as a global population, right? Because if we stated before that things are getting we're getting more people, and people who make money tend to
And people are getting richer.
use more energy, and the things we can do with energy, although it's becoming more efficient, I think there's going to be ever more uses for energy. I mean, if you've got it, you're going to be able to put it to use, right? So rather have too much than too little. And I think, yeah, you're right. I think specifically in like, I know there's like a solar to hydrogen plant that was proven viable for like kilowatt, I think kilowatt scale, which is quite cool. So like, especially for things like smelters, and really heavy industry, rather than using electricity and then turning that into heat, using hydrogen into heat. And if that's a better option, I think that's probably a better way to go. But I think there's a lot of technology that kind of needs to be built up to support that, right? Because
So I agree with you. I think that hydrogen is an interesting one, and I think we should do an entire episode on it in the new year. But hydrogen is both very difficult to transport and also very easy to transport. Let me explain. If you are a country in the middle of the Sahara Desert, right, and you build out a really, really big solar farm, and you start generating a whole bunch of energy, and you want to sell that energy to the market, assuming that you're on the ocean as well. So Morocco is a great example, or pretty much anywhere in East Africa, Egypt, whatever, is you can do one of two things. You can go and you can set up incredibly expensive high voltage power lines that deliver that energy to the markets that want it most, such as Europe. And along the way, firstly, very, very expensive to set up this infrastructure, but also along the way, there's a whole bunch of energy losses. And then the second way is to turn it into hydrogen by, doing that whole conversion using water, generally desalinated water from the ocean, and solar electricity, and then you stick it onto those big old pressurized liquid hydrogen tankers, and you ship them to the market. And that's why I say it's both complicated and it's not complicated. It's awful to ship hydrogen because it promotes corrosion. It makes things like aluminium and steel brittle. And it always has to be kept at a very cold temperature and under a very high pressure, which is very much unlike our existing, hydrocarbons. There are a couple of companies that are working on doing atmospheric carbon dioxide removal, but not for sequestration, but instead to combine with the hydrogen to turn it into a more easily transportable fuel source. So you essentially add a little bit of carbon and a little bit of hydrogen, and you have some form of hydrocarbon that is more easily shipped to market. And that's actually a pretty novel idea. And you could, still claim that it is net zero because you're removing that carbon. It just happens to go back into the atmosphere.
As long as, yeah, I guess as long as it's extracting carbon along the way, right? And I think it
Or
makes
even if
valid
it's not,
points.
even if it is completely net zero, that's okay. I would like them to say, like, there may become legislation in the future where if you're doing that, you have to sequester 10% of the carbon that you pull out of the atmosphere. But even if you don't, you're not injecting more, or at least that the process isn't explicitly emitting carbon dioxide.
And I think that's maybe what leads on to the next thing.
One of the big things that has been leading the charge in the renewable energy space and in the energy space overall are these pretty nifty models that allow us to do neat things with computers. And it has now been about a year and a half since large language models really like hit the public scene, most notably with ChatGPT. And work has changed a lot during that time. Like I recently just released a game on the Playdate, which is a little device, little Game Boy-like device, but it has a crank. And I had to code it in Lua, and I've never coded in Lua before. So instead of doing my usual thing where I go and figure out the syntax and everything, I just jumped right into building the project, and ChatGPT generated a lot of the code. Now, Lua is fairly easy to read, but all I was doing is I was auditing and editing code. I wasn't actually like writing code from scratch. And that was pretty huge. And, this is both really good and bad things. I think education is going to be severely hampered by this because all take-home assignments can reasonably be done by ChatGPT. And so learning is going to become significantly more difficult because a lot of learning centers around getting the students to do it themselves, because that's how you learn.
So it's a big topic, and almost like
Almost it's too big to cover as like a 10 minute.
I don't think my ears have heard the word AI as much as this year ever. And to some extent, you just kind of like need to just switch off just to not hear those two letters. But yeah, you're right. I think the quintessential 2023 fact is like AI got big, and more specifically, the transformer-based AI. Via ChatGPT has gotten really, really big. And what I really like is that it's not just ChatGPT anymore. There are some, albeit not as impressive, although I don't know if you've looked at Gemini, but there are some impressive sort of contenders for ChatGPT. So I'm quite pleased that it's not just a sort of proprietary one horse race. We've seen Llama 2 become sort of almost de facto in some of the open source model space. I think Mistral, that was released recently, I mean the last couple of months, is also good open source models. And what I really like is there's kind of like a almost as with the superconductors, that there's like a nice hype in the open source community around these models, leading to more innovation. But I guess the questions are still out there as to the ethical nature of AI. Like, what's education going to look like? What about copyright infringement?
Oh, I'm more afraid of, and this is not LLMs, but GANs and other image generation models, in that I'm afraid of what the 2024 United States election is going to look like, because it's just like creating fake content to sway public opinion is just a thing in United States. Well, all elections, but United States is famous for it. And now it's going to be even worse. Like you can create great realistic video of your candidate doing and saying anything, and it's easy to do.
Actually, that's another thing that happened this year is Twitter now is ex formerly Twitter.
It's now X.
And I do notice that trend, right? So I'm still on Twitter. And I go on there and it's kind of getting a bit annoying. Like you'll see a post and then almost like immediately afterwards, you can see there's like an AI generated dude who's like, he's, scripted some API nonsense. And now he's like making the best response tweet for said post, right? So you've got like someone with original thought, maybe it's even AI generated. And then you've got immediately like these sort of script boys who are like, sliding in afterwards to respond to try and build a clout.
Yeah, and that's so easy to do, hey?
It's so easy to do, and all you're doing is just like taking this writer comp like a thoughtful response and then post it onto Twitter. And you can you get verified for that and use the APIs, which I think is
annoying.
Annoying.
Have you noticed like getting emails from colleagues and stuff that are just like so well written that you know that it wasn't them?
And also like I've heard rumors that Google is also getting like really bad now, like it's just surfacing loads of junk.
It is. If you take a look at like if you go and Google an animal, let's say you go and Google a lion, Google image search, the first page is going to pretty much be all AI generated lions. It's pretty wild because Google also has that recency bias. It's built into their algorithm. They want to show more recent content. The problem is that it's significantly more easy to go and generate an image of a lion than it is to go and take a picture of a lion. And then on a personal front, you know, the blogging platform I run, Bear, is I have had to up the anti-spam game. And the problem is that a lot of the time I'm not sure. I'm like, is this just someone who writes well? Or is this actually a spam blog? And then I'll have to like really dig into it. And then I'll see a post where it's pushing some online gambling company or a crypto company. I'm like, oh. Maybe I just have to make everyone pay. It turns out you can't just generate money yet.
And there's actually a word, there's a word for this called dead internet theory. And it's this theory that the internet is actually just all bots and there's no actual people on it. And it's just a way to kind of distract people from their normal lives, right?
Oh, so here's the interesting thing, right? Is LLMs are being trained to speak language, human language, let's say English. They speak in English. And now what happens is some of the people online are now bots. And so then bots are responding to those bots. And at some point, most of the traffic online and most of the comments and replies and posts and everything are going to be bots. And so we're going to have a essentially like a weird dark forest of the internet, where it's just bots speaking to bots speaking to bots. But here's where it's interesting, is that they're all speaking English, right? It's like we went and we trained computers to speak in English so that they could speak to each other in English, which is a very, very inefficient way of communicating, especially for computers. So it's kind of like a clown show if you think about it.
It is for us though, but if you think about the previous thing that happened this year, if India is now the most populous country on Earth, the thing that India has that China doesn't is it has access to the internet. So, and I think we've already passed this last year or the year before, but the there's more people on the internet who are living in India or from India than any other country. So there's no reason to say that if you want to, if you're a profit-seeking organization, that you should be generating content in English. Maybe it is that English happens to be more coincided with people who have a propensity to pay in certain circumstances. But if you wanted the most reach, you would have it in India, Indian dialects, right? It might be a bit difficult because there's not one Indian language. So you would have to have sort of nuance between the two, between the different sort of regions. But there's, why wouldn't you just have, speaking those languages specifically?
I have a hard time thinking of what would be a use of reach, basic reach, right?
I mean, it's click-through ads, man. Like, plus.
Okay, sure. Click-through ads, but like click-through ads are their underlying value is people actually buying those products, right? The market
Well,
corrects for
people
that.
buy ads. That's the thing. It's not.
That's true. That's true. But people buy ads, and they unless it's something India specific, they really want to sell to Americans. Like Americans are the people who pay for things on the internet.
That's true. Yeah, so I mean that is that's a valid point. But I think the thought experiment is nonetheless quite interesting, is that, as you said, English is the predominant language and these LLMs actually can speak other languages, right? They just happen to be trained on our language more. And so I think maybe in 2024 we'll see that diversity sort of increasing.
They can actually speak other languages really well. So, my mother and I recently wrote a paper that was specifically looking at the ability for GPT-4 to tutor mathematics in Zulu, and then a separate paper tutoring mathematics in Arabic. And it handled both of those very well. However, the Zulu one had significantly more mistakes, grammatical mistakes, but it was still fully understandable, and people could use it with no problems. And that's because Zulu has a significantly smaller training base than, say, Arabic, which is a huge, huge population base. But then when we tried it with things like isiXhosa, terrible. It would just print out nonsense. And I'm not even sure if the nonsense was from ChatGPT or if it was from Google Translate, because the only way that I could tell if it was making sense was putting it back through Google Translate, and it would come back just hallucinating everything. Like, not even hallucinating facts, but just like hallucinating how sentences are supposed to work.
And those hallucinations are kind of contrary to what, well, they sort of back up your previous comment, is that these models are kind of sort of trained to fool humans, right? Because like when you look at two pieces of text, what are the humans who are evaluating thinking? They're like, which one's looks more real, or which one looks more appealing to a human? It might not, I mean, like, because we also have, I mean, there's certain biases that we have, which are probably quite hard to sort of completely rule out. And so, yeah, I mean, maybe it just hallucinates really compelling, writing and jargon. But yeah, I think that it's going to be interesting to see in 2024, like how it all develops. Especially the internet thing. I think it might be cool to play around with the idea of a private internet. I almost think about it like, you have like a wasteland, and that's like the real internet is like full of bots and sort of fakes. And then you have like these bastions of hope, where you have a siloed sort of forum, where you have very high levels of vetting, where you actually have to go and shake someone's hand to get in, and then you just live on this internet.
I think that you and I were part of a very interesting generation, and exactly that is that I think that we saw the peak of social media. We saw the most amount of people on one platform ever in history, but I think potentially ever in the future as well. So we saw the peak of social media, and it's been declining ever since. It turns out when you take billions of people and you put them all on the same platform, they don't get along too well. But now with the rise of chatbots, it's going to become even more noisy, and there's going to be a lot more agenda. And people before ChatGPT or before these LLMs became a thing were already leaving the platform, and now they're leaving these platforms at a greater rate and opting for smaller communities. And so I can definitely see things like I'm part of a ZA Tech, which is a Slack chat community in South Africa, and it's great. I even had dinner and drinks out with a handful of them last week, and whenever someone untoward like manages to get onto the platform, it's immediately flagged and taken care of. But it takes work. It takes there like there has to be moderators who sit there and be like, okay, this person is obviously, a bot or a Indian dev house looking for clients.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
so I completely agree with you. We're gonna see the rise of smaller, more intimate communities. And I'm actually here for that because I think it's better. To everyone listening, thanks for, listening to us for this year. And we'll catch you again in 2024. Share our podcast with other people if you think this was entertaining or informative. And if you want, leave us a comment, leave us a rating, and have a fantastic holiday.
Cheers.